This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
About doing this, Alan, what do you think? I mean, do you have conversations a lot like
absolutely,
that?
Absolutely, yeah. And what, you know, tell me the history and why do you do things a certain way? And we also worked together on the season planning this year. I came in, of course, with a short list of plays, you know, in my pocket that I sort of ran for the job on. And then Artist Rep had a short list of plays they were considering. And we worked together quite a bit.
Is that unusual for an artistic director to sort of have this long transition period?
I think that the way that this has been handled is unusually good. I don't think we usually get a 6-month transition.
No, it's just you have to start on the job.
That's
don't
right,
you?
Right. Or you know maybe there's a month of overlap or something like that. And oftentimes an artistic director inherits a title of plays, and their first year is really someone else's programming, and that's not the case. They designed it so that we would have that overlap and collaboration, but also Alan has generously kind of gifted me with the power to, you know, control what my first year is like.
Yeah, this is a big gift because this was his baby for so many, many years,
that's
decades.
Right. 25 years, and I think that's why they put together this long and thorough process and a smart transition.
Well, I have to say, Tommaso, you have an impressive background as an associate artistic director of the Pasadena Playhouse and co-founder and resident director of Furious Theater. And I'm just reading some of your highlights here. You're a recipient of the Los Angeles Drama Critics Circle Award. You've directed shows at many major theaters throughout the country. So what made you want to apply for this job and come to Portland?
Well, I should say I was quite happy in Los Angeles. I've been there 14 years, when the job came up, it looked like an unusually good fit aesthetically. Like I looked at the history at Artist Rep. The plays are plays that I would have produced or wanted to produce through the years, and it resembled the company that I co-founded in Los Angeles. And so I felt a kind of connection to it. And I really liked the model here at Artist Rep, which is as the company grew, instead of building a 500 or 600 seat theater, it chose to stay intimate, and it has two theaters, a 220 seat.
Two intimate theaters.
Right. A 220 seat, 164 seat, which is sort of like that off-Broadway size. And it supports the company's commitment to new work, which is what I'm really interested in. And I just like this as a new kind of professional theater model. It's like keep it small so that you can keep taking risks.
Well, had you been to Portland before? Had you heard of Artist Rep before?
I had worked in Seattle in 2010 at Intimont Theater, and so in hanging out there, I kind of became more aware of the scene in Portland by, you know, because of who you run into in town. And that was my connection to Portland, really. And my intro to the Pacific Northwest and just sort of, you know, imagining myself being up here was a little bit easier, at least because I'd been up here in the Northwest for some time. But I had not been to Portland until my first interview in town.
Well, do you miss L.A.? Do you miss Los Angeles?
No.
Well, that was quick. No thought in there. What is it you like about here? I mean, obviously this great job, but
yeah, this great job. And the truth is, I'm still in transit. I still go back to LA every other week. My family's still in LA, and everyone is moving up here July 1st. My wife and two kids. And what I like the sense of community here. You feel it. I like the lifestyle. I can, you know, I'm not living here really yet, but I can tell from talking to people there's a real passion for the community here and the environment here. And I like the cultural scene here, the theater scene here. It's a tight, connected group of artists working together. Everyone seems to know each other. Everyone seems to have worked together, but it's quite expansive. I mean, I hear there's 80 or 100 companies putting on plays all
is
over
there
town.
That many?
That's the word I'm getting.
No wonder I have so much emails.
Right.
Yeah, that is. It has really burgeoned, especially in the last 10 years, yeah. This artistic community. So, Tommaso, you have a strong history of directing classic plays and new work, and that does seem like a good mix for what Artist Repertory does, which is a mix of classic and new works.
That's right. Primarily focused on new and contemporary work, but mixed within that, a show or two a year historically is something of of a classic. And my focus moving forward, and you'll see it in our first season, we are doing a classic. We're doing The Playboy of the Western World, which was written in 1907.
That's one of the first plays that I actually read out loud to myself, you know,
wow.
when we didn't have a drama program in high school. So
that's cool.
I did it
in high school. That's how I became exposed to that play. And but that play, it was kind of edgy in its time, and there were riots in Dublin after it was performed. It's quite funny, and by today's standards, relatively harmless. You wouldn't riot after the play. But the point is that that's a play that had Artist Rep existed in 1907, Artist Rep would have had the courage to do. And so when we do a classic, I think we're going to look at it through that context, and the classic will be in kind of dialogue with the contemporary provocative new plays.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of input into the next season, the 2013-2014 season.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, now, since you come from L.A., where there is more diversity in ensembles, are you bringing that into, you know, the Portland community too? More artists of color at Artist Rep, do you think?
Well, that's something I certainly aspire to, and the company aspires to. You know, the company has a long history with international work, and so I want to build upon that. You know, next season we're doing The Invisible Hand, and we're bringing a couple of actors from Pakistan that Alan Noss worked with during his travels in the last few years. So yes, the answer is yes. I have to get to know this community and understand how diversity works in Portland. But I think that's the future of everything we do, and future of American theater is trying to reflect the world in which we live. And if you don't have diversity, well, you're not doing that.
Well, I think we could do a better job with it. I mean, that's my personal opinion, but I think there is a movement now to really take a look at it. It's sort of been on the back burner for mm-hmm. a while, mm-hmm. you know, so it's starting to be of concern because
right.
we are changing as a community.
Yeah. So that's definitely something that I expect, us to achieve moving forward.
Well, you're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. If you missed any of this show, you can hear it again at stageandstudio.org. I'm talking with Damaso Rodriguez, and I want to bring actress Linda Alper into this conversation. Linda, you know, you've worked 23 seasons at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and throughout the country, all over in major theaters, including two Artist Repertory Theater productions, and you've just returned as a Fulbright Scholar in Taiwan. Now, you've been going back a couple times now. How was your recent trip? And, you know, I just want to know why it was you wanted to do this in this point in your career.
I've actually always been interested in international work, and I spent a fair amount of time in Europe and Italy when I was at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and learned fairly good Italian and did translating of Italian plays. So, and then our daughter, who's now almost 24 years old, became an Asiaphile. So
yeah, she studied Chinese.
She
right?
speaks Chinese
yeah,
and she speaks right. Japanese, and she now lives in mainland China. So I was offered an opportunity about 3 years ago to teach in Beijing and Hong Kong, which I took very eagerly. And through that opportunity, I became aware of the Fulbright program in Asia, and then I applied. And I've always wanted to live, as has my husband, in another culture for at least, you know, for a whole year, and not be a tourist, not be a student, but be really integrated into the culture. So when I got the Fulbright, I was thrilled. And it also, I think, really marked a transition in terms of leaving OSF and going to another kind of community and another kind of work. So, and it's been great. And I just was brought back to Taipei on what was called a National Science Council grant I wrote a new play that was about my experiences there, specifically about language. I was teaching in English Chinese students who were Mandarin speakers, doing a play doing a Shakespeare play in English. At the same time, I was communicating with my mother, who was losing her language through dementia. And so it was a really kind of fascinating dichotomy. So this play is still in process. I did the reading there with a combination of myself, some students, colleagues, expats. So it was a real community project. And now I'm still working on it.
That sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to talk more about that, definitely. Now you're playing the famous stage actress Lynn Fontanne in Ten Chimneys. And I have to say, it seems like a role you were destined to play. I mean, I've seen photographs, and there's a striking resemblance between you and the real Lynn Fontanne. I mean, did you notice that at all?
Not really.
Not really?
Thank you. That's very nice.
I did.
I would think so. I would think so. And so, you know, for those who may not be familiar with her, because she wasn't in films. I mean, she was a stage actor. She was in a few, you know, but she isn't known for that.
And her husband, Alfred Lunt, only made one big film,
right,
which I was able to see.
Oh, good. I was going to ask you about that because she was nominated for that, I believe. Yeah.
And I was able to go down to the Southern Oregon Library where they have a big collection of these films and watch this old videotape in the library. I wasn't allowed to take it out of the library. And it was definitely a film of a stage production. It was not it didn't seem like a modern movie. But their performances were phenomenal. As comedians, they are first rate, and it feels as modern as anything you see today, as a romantic comedy you would watch today. And the way they work together, because they worked together their entire careers, they were married, they were committed to working together, is just, it's kind of heavenly. So, and I get to work with my dear friend Michael Mendelsohn.
He actually has, I could see him playing Alfred.
Yes, he's wonderful, yeah. And we're good friends. So I kind of feel like we can be like an old married couple. And I have to say, it's really wonderful working with Damaso. He's definitely an actor's director, that I know about him already. And we're having a wonderful time, and we're working very hard.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, how is she different from other leading ladies that you've played? What is it about her?
She's cool, and I am not cool. So that's
cool
one thing.
In what respect?
And I don't know, actually, as she's written by Jeffrey Hatcher, I don't know that she is cool. He was famous for being a little bit hysterical. He's actually a kind of a quirky, goofy comedian when you see him in a very modern way. And then she was... Her sort of persona as an actress was somewhat domineering, the kind of cool female that the crazy man is around. So I don't think that's I usually play people who are a lot more
have a lot more emotional.
Usually, I mean, I know
hysterical.
This, but,
okay, yeah, I was going to say emotional range.
Emotional, tough. You know,
yeah, highly charged.
Highly charged. Yes.
But she seems to be kind of the witty, no coward-esque kind of banterish.
And then also, of course, we're dealing with what her persona was, and then what Jeffrey Hatcher has written in order to create this drama about these people. So we see them kind of on and off the stage, mostly off. But that's one of the delightful things about the play, I think.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Michael Mendelsohn, also a veteran actor and resident company member of the Artist Rep company. And he plays your husband and also, you know, the also famous Alfred Lunt. And you've talked about their relationship. So, Damaso, how have you been working with the two? What are you, you know, how is the style of this play of Ten Chimneys for you in working with these two as the famous couple?
Well, I think you were right at the beginning about you want to cast actors that sort of naturally inherit the role or inhabit the role. Both, I should say, inherit and inhabit the role. And so we haven't spent a lot of time talking about how or the style in which they should play together. It's really I think a lot of that's dictated by the text. And it is rapid fire. And there's a coward-esque quality. And that is appropriate to these two. But I think Michael and Linda, their instincts, I rely on that. And I sort of let them and their history together kind of reveal the history that this couple has. So I really do feel like you trust the actors to pursue their own instincts, and sometimes a lot of those things take care of themselves.
Well, Lunt and Fontanne were famous for their home, Ten Chimneys, and that's, you know, the Ten Chimneys of Ten Chimneys, the play, where they invite actors to come as a sort of theater retreat, and it's now a National Historic Landmark. But this play is set in 1938, when Lunt and Fontanne decide to stage Chekhov's The Sequel, and so they have this retreat. So it's sort of a comedy, but there's poignancy, and what happens at this retreat? What doesn't, I guess, happen at this retreat?
That's right. Well, this is sort of a byproduct, the whole play, of Jeffrey Hatcher's imagination saying, wow, they were known for rehearsing plays in their summer estate. And in 1938, they did The Seagull, which is set out in a country estate. So they're rehearsing a play about actors rehearsing a play out on a country estate. And so the play maybe begins in this kind of cowardesque, hay fever-like way, and then it starts to evolve into this very Chekhovian tragicomic play. And I think, meanwhile, it's all about the theater. So you have actors talking about the reality of committing to real work, because the Lunts were known for being very real on stage, very natural, very method-like. And yet everything about the play is sort of self-reflective and commenting on itself. So they're talking about doing Chekhov and behaving like Chekhov's characters. They're constantly referencing Noel Coward and behaving like Coward characters. I think it's a lot of fun for a theater audience that knows those other writers.
Well, Linda, you are fantastic with dialects. Is there a specific way that she's speaking, that Fontaine is speaking?
It's British.
Is it really British?
She was a Brit.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
She was a Brit, although when I listened to her...
Not the American kind of transatlantic. It's definitely British.
It's got a little bit of the transatlantic. It's actually a little less British than High British. And Alfred was a little bit transatlantic. So, and my training, I mean, it's kind of interesting, was when you still were taught to speak mid-Atlantic. When I went to school... a long time ago, we still were taught to get rid of any of our regional speech. And this, I remember we would go home and everybody would say, you sound so phony. I don't want to talk to you. And our teacher would say, darling, change your friends. So, you know.
Well,
so I think she speaks like my teacher
right,
did.
Right, right, right. So what's your favorite thing to say is Lynn Fontaine?
Oh, I can't say it on the air.
Oh, you can't? Oh, there's that kind of language, is there?
A little bit.
Oh, wow.
It's a very, very funny play.
Yeah, okay. But what's your favorite thing about her?
Her wit.
Aspect. Her wit.
Okay. I mean, I have a passion for language. I mean, I spent so many years in a Shakespeare company. And and I think Jeffrey is a very witty writer. And I admire his rhythm. And he writes very funny lines. And I have some lines, I feel like they're right out of a Restoration comedy. They're so balanced in terms of the wit that he's presenting. And for somebody that could think that fast, because she's the wittiest when she's the most angry. I wish I could be like that in real life.
Yeah, because does she go into launch into these huge speeches or something?
They're not even huge speeches. Yeah. They're just
beautiful lines.
Put together barbs.
Though there are scenes that could be straight out of Private Lives in terms of these sort of like vicious fights, you know, very clever.
Well, it sounds like, Damaso, that it's been actually quite fun working with Linda and Michael and the cast for this show.
Yes.
It's kind of an interesting entree into this season for you, isn't it?
Because, absolutely.
Yeah.
I feel like I lucked out. I ended up, because, you know, Todd Van Voorhis, who's a company member and kind of beloved around the theater scene here, is also in it. I have Chris Harder, who's working all over town, Sarah Lucht. Joanne Johnson. I have like a kind of who's who of Portland theater and really artist rep history. Everybody has a lot of shows in the artist rep repertory, a lot of those credits. It's a pretty fantastic group. And then we have one actor who I knew from Los Angeles playing the outsider in the play, which I think is kind of appropriate.
Okay.
Uta Hagen.
Oh, yeah. Because
the play does
yeah.
center around in this production. Uta Hagen began. She's a famous acting teacher, and she was only 18 years old when she was cast by the Lunts, and she didn't survive the entire run. She
now,
was
why is that? Because I find that fascinating, because she started her own acting school and the Uta Hagen method.
She's a
and
titan.
All that.
She's
yeah.
one of the luminaries yeah. of the American theater. So, again,
and she didn't fit in with them.
Right. And so the play, I won't spoil it, but the play does answer that question.
I like that.
By the end of the play, yeah. you find out what happened. And really, that's the inspiration for
and
the play.
She's sort of the new wave, isn't she?
She's the new wave, but their conflicts are almost in that they reflect the characters in Chekhov's The Seagull. So she is the ingenue and caught up in a bit of a triangle with the Lunts, just like the characters that they're playing in The Seagull.
Interesting. Well, that I like that element. I forgot about that, and I definitely am looking forward to that. The West Coast premiere of Ten Chimneys by Jeffrey Hatcher is directed by Damaso Rodriguez. The play at Artist Repertory Theater features Linda Alper as Lynn Fontaine and Michael Mendelsohn as Alfred Lunt. Performance dates are April 23rd through May 26th, Wednesday through Sunday at 7:30 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. Opening night is Friday, April 26th. Performances are at Artist Repertory Theater, Theater's Alder Stage, and that's at 16th and Morrison Street. For more info or reservations, call 503-241-1278, 241-1278, or visit artistsrep.org. And we have a pair of tickets to offer to the first, actually to the third, now let's make it the fourth caller here at KBOO, who calls in at 503-231-8032, fourth caller, you can pick up a pair of tickets to Artist Rep's production of Ten Chimneys. Linda Alpert, looking forward to seeing you in this show as Lynn Fontaine, and Damaso Rodriguez, looking forward to seeing your direction of Ten Chimneys. And truly a pleasure to meet you and to talk with both of you today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's been great. Next up, we hear from writer and radio producer Bing Bingham in northern central Oregon. As we enter spring and more light is coming into our lives, it's always good to remember our pets who have helped us through dark times.
Me and my aging stock dog were bickering like an old married couple. It was raining lightly on a cold and blustery day. I hurried across the yard looking for a staple gun in a tool shed. Out of habit, I called my dog to come with me. Halfway across, I realized she wasn't tagging along. Standing in the rain, I used a hand signal for her to come with me. Her body language indicated she wasn't sure I really meant what I said. I sighed and gestured again. She continued to ask, "Are you sure?" I could easily stop what I was doing and force a battle of wills. We both know who'd win. After all, she and I have worked together for many years. The weather was uncomfortable. Her arthritic hips were aching. I hadn't indicated by the timbre in my voice that I really wanted her to come. She was probably hearing her name called more clearly by the warm rug next to the wood stove, a very selective type of hearing. Willie and I have been together since she was born 12 years ago. We know each other well, maybe too well. When I'm frustrated, she's usually in a shadow waiting for me to get over it. If I'm in a hurry, she stays three paces behind to avoid getting stepped on. When I'm distracted, she'll hang out and wait for me to, mentally, return home. For years, she's been my emotional barometer. When I breathe out, she breathes in. When she breathes out, I breathe in. My old dog was hurting in the chilly and damp weather. From her point of view, she was asking a legitimate question. Is what you're doing important enough for me to push through this haze of pain and follow you? I decided it wasn't. Come or don't, I said, but I'm headed to the tool shed and out of this rain. I turned and hurried across the lawn. A few moments later, my little black shadow was hot on my heels. After more than a decade, our relationship is changing. We no longer allow her to jump fences. Her job is to guard the ranch ATV and keep marauding sheep from the grain buckets. Mostly, though, she's content to sit back and watch the action while the next generation handles the rough stuff. That's okay with me. I understand. I don't handle the rough stuff like I did when I was a youngster. One day, her time will come, and that's fine, too. We've had a good long run. I'm content to spend the time we have left bickering on the porch or daydreaming by the wood stove. Either way, we'll be doing what we've always done best. Me breathing in, her breathing out. Her breathing in, and me breathing out.
And that was Bing Bingham. Bing Bingham lives on a remote ranch in northern central Oregon, where he works as an independent writer, photographer, and radio producer. Read more of his stories at Bing Bingham, that's BingHam.com. And we'll have that link at stageandstudio.org as well. That's it for Stage and Studio today. My thanks to cable engineer Janet Anderson. Now, if you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. And you can also download shows there as a podcast, but also at iTunes. And we'll have a link at stageandstudio.org. And also check out our Facebook page. Don't forget to like us on Facebook.com/stage, the letter N, studio. And you can always tweet me with your events or updates or just to say hello with your comments at stage, the letter N, studio. And you can email me at stage, the letter N, studio at AOL.com. kbooks.com. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We're going out now with another song by Michael Hoppe and his CD Nostalgie, available at michaelhoppe.com, and that's HOPPE.com.
Good morning. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. My name is Ava Lake, and I have a special guest with me today. I have with me today Brian Fariso, who is the director of the Portland Art Museum. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You were here once when you first arrived to town with Julie Bernard, right?
That's right.
So maybe 6 years ago, something like
that?
That's
right, about 6 years ago.
And so you've got all this work done now, and people have sort of been evaluating constantly the type of job that you're doing at the museum. What I kind of want to do today, though, is talk about art and talk about your journey as an artist as well as a director of a museum. And just kind of want to get into like how being a practicing artist affected what you do at the museum. First of all, just a little bit of background. Your education is varied. You studied economics first, yes?
Yes, so studied economics at Bowdoin College, but then really every semester always took my art course because I love studio art. It was painting, drawing, design, all of those were always a central part of my curriculum undergraduate. So it really planted a strong seed.
Right. So this whole time you thought maybe you were going to work in economics or in finances, and then you realized when it was all done that what was the turning point? You were working at a museum, you were volunteering somewhere, or?
Well, you know, we're always looking for that authentic experience in life, and you know, we have these assumptions when we're growing up about that we actually know what we want. We actually don't know what we want. So, you know, finishing college, having my practical economics degree, which was very practical, I was good at it, but it was always sort of art that drew me to what I really believed in and passionately. And I always found myself at museums, around studios. I loved the smell of oil paint and those types of experiences. So I had a great opportunity where someone said, well, you know, you're not working now, Brian, you're bartending, and why don't you become an art teacher? And we have a position and you can teach art. So I became an art teacher.
Wow.
And at the same time, I was very close to New York City. So I needed to spend more time really developing my painting skills. I'd done a lot of drafting and a lot of drawing, a figure drawing, a lot of figurative work and gestural sort of studio time, but never intense studio, or at least painting.
Right.
So I went to the Art Students League to really delve deep into that. So I teach during the day and go to the art students at night.
So wait a minute now. You say you were teaching. Was these with these two kids? Where were you?
High school kids.
High school kids.
So high school kids, middle school, and doing all that. You know, the other aspect of this is I played a lot of sports in college and in high school, so they needed a coach. So I coached.
You did all of that. Well, you know, my high school art teacher was the best art teacher I ever had. I mean, I always say that to her. And so I imagine that in programs that are at the museum now, you can kind of still reflect back from when you were teaching kids and know the importance and know what kids are looking for and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I thought what I really enjoyed about the Art Students League and then also when I was teaching was, you know, art is about an exploration. It's not a defined curriculum. It's about a journey. It's about really understanding materials, understanding who you are as a person, how you see and how you feel, and then getting the tools and gathering the tools to create and articulate those emotions and those sensibilities in through a work of art. And so all of that came together, and that's always been sort of the driving force for me of understanding art and also, you know, the focus of the museum.
Mm-hmm. So, but before you did the Art Students League, did you have an art history degree?
I had taken some art history classes in college. I also started to go to Columbia at night for graduate courses in art history.
Busy guy.
Yeah, so, you know, you're single. You know, you just do it. And I was a bartender, so I always had the opportunity to get some cash when I needed it to get to pay the path to get into the city. And
bartender in New York City?
No, bar we know? In New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
In New Jersey. And it was a great bar, and I still swing by there once in a while.
Cool.
And learned a lot. Actually, that's one of the great lessons I think many people can learn is how to relate to people through a bar is really important.
Yes.
But no.
Social skills.
Social skills. That's right. And communicating. But going to Columbia was really important, and having some really wonderful classes in art history there sort of planted the seed with the art making, the art history all coming together.
So the Art Students League, as you know, I went there too.
Right.
And I'm just going to say a couple things about it, and then I want to open the door with you. I remember having old magazines that I clipped out for my collaging, right? I'm talking turn of the century. And there were ads in the back for the Art Students League. Then I also remember reading in art history, you know, Georgia went there, Edward Hopper went there, even Andy Warhol went there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was so important for so long. So there was kind of a romance for me, a historical romance around this place. Then when you visit, the smell of turp